I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. Thank you for being here. We've got two cases that'll be argued on the 10 o'clock, and then we've got one case that'll be argued on the 11 o'clock docket. It's my understanding that the attorneys are all here for the first case for the 10 o'clock docket and are ready to proceed. Before we begin, though, I want to introduce our panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we hear our arguments, I'll have the clerk call the case.
The court will now call in the interest of James E. L. Child, and then please the court, Mr. Roger Dale, to argue for the appellant, Mr. Matthew Ridden, to argue for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Justices, we're here today on what amounts to a constitutional issue. Under the 14th Amendment, is the mother entitled to due process, and was that due process met? Ultimately, this comes down to a set of facts with regard to a balancing test under the Eldridge factors that the United States Supreme Court has talked about. What is the interest of the private parties? What is the interest of the governmental parties? And what is the chance of this being wrong if there is a problem with the due process? Presumptively, you've read the case law and know the facts with regard to this. The issue is the mother appeared for the adversary hearing on the 14-day adversary hearing, apparently mentally incapacitated, so much so that the court, trial court on its own, had a mental health professional in the gallery. Apparently at a break through the bailiff, the mental health professional signaled to the court that this woman was not suicidal, and the court said, well, if she wants to live under a bridge off Loop 288, she can do so. She can deal with her mental health issues through Denton County MHMR or not, her choice. At the conclusion of the hearing, after the court had preliminarily announced its ruling, taking away the mother's rights and assigning the interest of the child to the state at that point in time, the mother started offending the court by dropping expletives. She was escorted out of the court. At that point in time, the state's attorney said, we think it'd be appropriate to have a guardian ad litem for the mother. And presumptively, that guardian ad litem was Ms. Palmer, was appointed sua sponte by the court. She happened to be in the courtroom. When you look at her billing records, it looks like she had forenotice of that because she appeared on the court's docket on the 28th of September 2018. Subsequently, Ms. Palmer had a single touch with the mother, and that was on October 18th, where she said she explained the service plan and explained the visitation procedures with the mother.
Was there any indication in the record, because there's not on the order itself, of what authority the court was invoking to name a guardian ad litem for the mother?
There was not. Presumptively, Your Honor, the authority was under 107.010 of the Texas Family Code, and there was a subsequent motion to discharge the attorney ad litem or guardian ad litem under that section that was never set or heard.
In what manner is a trial court authorized to, what triggers the authorization under that provision for the appointment of a guardian ad litem?
It's not a concrete statement, and in fact we went back to the legislative history that we included in our reply brief, and it looks like it says we're continuing what has been the law, but it allows the court to appoint, it says, an attorney ad litem, but at that point in time we'd have two attorney ad litems if we're using the 107.010 statute. And in the bottom of that statute, it specifically says that the attorney ad litem, if appropriate, may make a reference to the, I'll call it the probate court, but the appropriate court for a guardianship proceeding. That did not occur.
Okay, so 107.010 010 actually talks about an attorney ad litem, doesn't actually say anything.
It does not say.
Guardian ad litem.
Correct.
Okay. So if a guardian ad litem is going to be appointed, it's going to have to be under some other authority, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And there are limitations on the appointment of a guardian ad litem by a trial court under the civil rules.
Under Rule 173 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, there are particular notations about an appointment of a guardian ad litem, but in the footnotes to those rules, it specifically says that that rule does not countermand anything that's in the family code or the probate code.
Right. Okay. There's a specific ground for termination that's predicated upon the mental illness of the parent, correct?
That's correct, and that's under...
If I remember your briefing correctly, you indicate that ground was not actually asserted as a basis for termination.
It was not in the pleading. At trial, around page 94 of the trial record, the trial counsel for the state says, we can proceed under 161-103, but we'll need to recess the trial at this point in time and go get evidence to support that. It was not in their normal pleading.
But there's literally nothing in the family code that talks about if, in fact, a termination SAPSR is brought and one of the grounds being sought for termination is a mental illness, mental incapacity of the parent to care for the child who is the subject of the SAPSR. There's literally no cross-reference by the family code to anything that would indicate that there has to be a preliminary hearing with regard to capacity or competency or anything of that nature.
There is not, and there's a case cited by both counsel and myself, I think in the interest of ELT, that came out of this court, if I'm thinking of the correct case, that basically says there is no requirement for a capacity determination, much as you would have in a criminal proceeding where you need to see whether somebody has the capacity to commit a crime based on the mens rea.
Okay. Are you aware of the case law that indicates that you cannot take a judgment against an incompetent person?
And that was the crux of our initial, is there a capacity argument with regard to the mother?
There's case law out there, usually in the context of contract action or a personal injury type of action, that indicates that the judgment's void if there's evidence that in fact the person it's taken against is incompetent. Period. End of story. And so, I'm guessing you found nothing that reconciles anything in the family code with regard to that case law.
We have not. There is not. If there were a bright line case, a case on all fours, I would have brought it. In terms of that, I think the best analogy is if we go to 107.010 and you look at the specific language in that, Justice Birdwell, it says that the attorney ad litem, which is a second attorney, may go to the appropriate court and have a guardianship established for that person. I created a flowchart.
And there's really nothing to indicate if someone is, you know, because mental illness can be of a temporary nature. So if somebody's off their meds, we deal with that on commitment cases all the time. Somebody's off their meds, they have a mental illness, they lack capacity to make decisions for themselves, they go back on their meds, all of a sudden they're basically in a good situation. So, but there's nothing in the family code that even contemplates the difference between someone who is permanently mentally ill and therefore permanently incapacitated and therefore can't take care of a child with someone who, if given appropriate services and undergoes those services, can actually return to competency with regard to care of the child.
It simply has been not been dealt with, as I've seen it, either in the case law or in the statute. It does not exist, but clearly the issue of the mental incapacity was not pled in the state's petition, but that's clearly what the state backdoored this case into, and they terminated based on the end ground and the O ground, constructive abandonment of the child and failure to follow a service plan. But going to your
but
point,
if the incompetency caused those two things to occur, then by pleading those by themselves without seeking the incompetency or the mental illness ground, you get to the same place with the termination.
Right, but you've done indirectly what theoretically you should not be able to do directly.
What should Judge Barnes have, what do you contend Judge Barnes should have done here that she didn't do?
Well, I think that she clearly paused in terms of what she did do. If you look at the transcript somewhere around page 62, I think what she did, she had a real concern of what was going on, and I've created a flow chart that I included in my reply brief, and I have other copies, but I believe you all have a color copy of that. I think that becomes a safe harbor for Judge Barnes or any judge in terms of that. You appoint an attorney ad litem under 107.010, then they're given a charge. Have an interview, talk to collaterals, do what you do as an attorney, and potentially that's an attorney who has already also been qualified under the guardian ad litem CLE that's required by our Supreme Court if you're going to have a guardianship. At that point in time, that trained attorney makes a determination. I don't have any business here. Judge Barnes, please release me. Or alternatively, there's a serious matter here. This needs to go to, in Denton County, the probate court.
Now, that's a best practice. I can see how you could say that's a best practice approach to handling this. But how do you contend that that's required by the law? I'm trying to connect what it is that the law mandates that she take this approach.
Okay. Under case law, once you give a parent a right in the establishment under 107.010, you have the right to an attorney ad litem. Then you have the right to effective assistance of counsel of that attorney. They must do what they've done. And what you've got here is a clear indication that Ms. Palmer perhaps met with my client on the 28th of September and did meet with her on October 18th. But there's no other indication, nothing in the record, nothing filed, of any opportunity that she took to either say the mother is competent and this case can go forward against her, or alternatively, this ought to go to the probate court in Denton County because...
But back to Justice Basil's question, what did Judge Barnes do wrong? You're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel. That's a different argument. That's an argument about what the attorney did wrong. What did Justice Barnes do wrong in this?
Well, I think she had a duty once she opened the door and appointed the attorney ad litem under 107.010 to move forward and make sure that counsel was effective. And,
so
and
you think the trial judge has an obligation to make sure that litigants get effective assistance of counsel?
When they're
what is the judge supposed to do if that's not happening?
Well, in this particular case, well, first of all, in the general scheme of a CPS case, there are at least three hearings before you get to a final hearing. There's a permanency hearing and two status hearings that occur. And along the line of that, we are judging where the parent is in the process. Additionally, CPS is required to report whether they're going to terminate, reunification, what is the goal. And while that goal is being examined, then the trial court has a hand in this much more than in a civil case where it's simply have your pleadings, have your discovery, and let's try the case. This is a much more hands-on procedure in CPS world.
But 107.010 seems to put the duty on, the last sentence seems to put the duty on the lawyer. It says the attorney ad litem shall follow the person's expressed objectives of representation and, if appropriate, refer the proceeding to the proper court for guardianship proceedings. So you're saying that Judge Barnes should be testing the lawyer as to whether or not she's abiding by that last sentence, or the last sentence is inadequate?
Well, I think clearly the last sentence is inadequate, but when it doesn't occur here and there's a request for a continuance and we're 9 months into the case, then the question is, are we protecting the interests of the parent that she has that are constitutionally protected? So, yes, I think there's more that needs to be done. I'm busy waiting for the red light to come on. If there are no further questions, I'll yield to my counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Don't really have any quarrel with counsel's recitation of the facts and the standing of this case as it is now here. It is clear that from the very beginning of the case, the trial court was concerned about the appellant's mental health. And to that end, she had a person observing, so forth, as counsel has stated, and also interlineated those temporary orders with a requirement that the appellant get treatment, either by returning to UBH, going to MHMR, something. She was then escorted from the courtroom, but she didn't do that. And unfortunately, that resulted in where we are today. She did not return for any of the other hearings or for her trial.
Let's assume that she's incompetent.
Okay.
Yeah, there's evidence of incompetence. Okay. So exactly how are we supposed to enforce a termination on an incompetent individual who's never actually demonstrated to be competent? I understand that there's a presumption of competence there, but if in fact we actually have an incompetent individual.
Here, I do want to say that, and I hope I'm not mistaken, I think that the department did plead 161 and 103. We are not relying on that, and as the counsel for the department said at trial, we would need to come back and prove up those facts if we're going to move forward under that. We're not relying on that, but because we proceeded the way that we did, and there is a presumption of competence, you had asked just now and earlier, how do you square that with those cases that say you can't take a judgment?
Right.
And there is also that line of cases, though, that are in my brief, that show that perhaps that line of cases really is not reconciled with the family code, and that the family code, because it, my position would be that because the best interests of the child are placed ahead of everything else, there are those lines of cases that show that an incompetent person can be terminated. And it's even set forth in the family code. It wasn't preceded, the department did not proceed under that, and the trial court did not proceed under that because of the lack of a mens rea requirement for what was already able to be proved with regard to abandonment.
Well, and, but let me ask you about that. Why? What safeguards are there to keep the department from, oh, gee, there's no mens rea, even though she's completely off her rocker and she's completely incompetent? We know we can go get these two that don't require us to deal with her competency issue, even though we absolutely know that the reason she can't do these other two things is because she's incompetent. So what obligation does the department have as a member of the government, okay, when dealing with someone who is evidencing incompetency? There are commitment procedures. There are, you know, it's the government can actually do something about people without having somebody else file. Obviously, an incompetent person is not going to file on themselves. And if nobody else, member of the public or friends or family, files, if they are in fact being a danger to somebody, then in fact the government can do something. Here, arguably, they're being a danger to their own child because they're mentally incompetent. So it looks like one part of the government is you know, operating on a set of facts, her incompetency, to deprive her of her relationship. But the other part of the government, who arguably would have notice of the incompetency because this part of the government does, okay, is taking no action to make sure that she's getting the actual mental health care that she's entitled to, which, if she received it, even in a commitment situation, might actually resolve the issues over here.
Well,
in other words, I think generally everybody agrees the family code is inadequate here, okay?
Oh, sure.
The real question, I agree with Justice Basil's question, which is, one, did Judge Barnes do anything wrong here? Okay. But
no. Judge Barnes didn't do anything wrong here, and I want to get to that. From the very beginning, she ordered mental health treatment. It's on appellate to get that mental health treatment. There is that provision in the family code that provides for termination because of incompetence. But where a parent conducts themselves in such a way, regardless of their competence, whether they're competent or not, they abandon the child, and it's in the best interest of the child to terminate, then termination is proper, regardless, because of the best interest of the child. So is there an obligation? The family code does not place that obligation. Here, that obligation was nevertheless met. The state was the party that requested the mental health treatment. The court ordered mental health treatment. The appellant didn't seek it. So regardless of whether her competence and regardless of whether she could be made competent, termination was proper on these facts.
So the family code has a specific. Did Judge Barnes actually have jurisdiction to order mental health services under the circumstances? Because isn't that something that's most appropriately handled under the jurisdiction of the probate court?
Well, Judge
And isn't that not exclusive over in the probate court?
Well, the probate court would probably have exclusive jurisdiction over MHMR type treatment where a person is a danger to themselves or others. The district court has the ability, because of the best interest of the child, and its broad discretion to make temporary orders that are befitting the case, so to speak, to order that, to interlineate that. And in that interlineation, it's not just go to MHMR. It is, she had been at UBH, go back to UBH, or some other treatment, I believe is the way it was worded.
Basically part of her service plan, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. And so it's important to approach this case from the perspective of what was in the child's best interest, not just what her competency was. Regardless of her competency, the way the trial court proceeded was proper and didn't do anything wrong. I think appellant has proposed an elegant solution to this with a decision tree if an ad litem is appointed and so forth, but that would have to be judicially created. We need a legislative solution. I think we all agree to that issue. On the facts of this case, the trial court proceeded in the way it should have.
Not much is made in the briefing about the meth use of the mother, but in looking at the record, it seems to me that some of the mental health issues and the meth use, which apparently was significant, are kind of interwoven. That some of the odd or antisocial behavior that was exhibited was, by her own testimony, or maybe it was the father's testimony, a result of the meth use rather than what we would traditionally call a mental health issue. Was that fleshed out, or was that discussed?
Well, because I think that's accurate, because of the way the case ended up being tried on abandonment and service plan, I don't know that it got fleshed out like it might have had the department proceeded also under D&E grounds. But best interest-wise, that is accurate. And regardless, again, of her mental health status, the meth use standing alone likely would have supported a termination.
Well, it seems to me it blurs the distinction between whether she's suffering from mental health problems, and I get that the record's pretty heavily laden with mental health concerns, but whether she's suffering from what we call a mental health issue or whether she's suffering from the effects of chronic and frequent meth use.
Or both.
Yeah, right. And the family code did not place a duty to pursue a competency evaluation. We don't have anything on paper by a psychiatrist that says appellant is incompetent that is in the record. And so yes, the problem here with the family code is that there's no requirement for that. Is that even a problem? The argument is there that because, again, of the best interest of the child, regardless of the appellant's mental health status, determination is appropriate here because of the abandonment and because of the situation of the child that's in the record in the best interest.
And that's the balance that RMT struck, wasn't it?
That is
the Texarkana court.
That's accurate. And if you look at those factors, one of the factors was the child's interest in a quick resolution to something like this and not being in that environment. And I think that weighed pretty heavily on the RMT court. And I think that weighs pretty heavily here as well. Again, I don't have much quarrel with, I think we all agree here on what the facts are. And if there are no more questions, I will yield to counsel.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
I don't think there's a argument that I have with counsel that there is no requirement on a competency hearing on the mother in this case or in any case, but frankly, I think that's incumbent upon the attorney ad litem, Ms. Palmer, to have referred this case. When you look at the MHMR records, and there appears in the MHMR records, not going outside the record that's before this court, there was a probate case that had been opened and nothing else developed in terms of that. We don't know what is in that file, whether the probate court found the mother to be competent or not.
Is that initiated by Ms. Palmer?
It does not appear.
Or does the record reflect?
Well, it's part of the MHMR records that were brought into court prior to Ms. Palmer being appointed. They were part of the initial 14-day adversary hearing.
Temporally, one would think that was a probate proceeding that had preceded the appointment of the guardian ad litem.
Correct.
Or the attorney ad litem.
Correct. And again, because we are talking about a constitutionally protected right, the rights of the mother, and at the point in time that this case is initiated, they are in line with the child because...
Let me just ask this then. If, in fact, the record before the family court indicates that there is a probate proceeding that is open, does not the family court have the duty to investigate its own jurisdiction vis-a-vis the probate proceeding? Because there are certain probate proceedings that take precedence over all others, are there not?
Well, I think so under, I think it's Rule 34, that ostensibly when there is a statutory probate court under the Estates Code, that statutory probate court has equal dignity with a district court and perhaps the power to bring things into its court if they're tangential to an action that is going on. We don't know whether that case had been concluded, remained open, or was pending closure because they couldn't find the mother. I just don't know, and I didn't go look in the record. I think those records are sealed without under mental health court, without the court's ability to open them, and frankly, at the appellate level, I didn't want to go outside the record that was here. So I don't have an answer for that, but it clearly begs the question of when we get to 9 months and 2 weeks and we have a one-year deadline and the ability to extend this case for another 6 months, another 180 days, why we didn't take the appropriate measures to make sure this was done right.
But jurisdiction was never actually asserted, and there was no discussion before Judge Barnes about, hey, there's this probate proceeding that may or may not be open. That wasn't a basis for any type of continuance argument.
It was not. The only basis was we can't find our client and we're not ready to go. There's more time left in this case. Let's use it.
Okay, are you aware of any case law? Let's assume, just for purposes of argument, that the probate court, in fact, had opened up a guardianship proceeding with regard to the mother here. Okay, how there's clearly some type of interaction. She's subject to two different courts now. One of which is dealing with a guardianship issue based upon her mental health, the other dealing with the impact of that with regard to her relationship with her children. Is there any case law that you're aware of where that type of interaction has been addressed by the courts at all?
I can't cite you to a case, but in guardianship proceedings there is an ad litem and they are given an order, and it grants them certain authority and divests the ward of authority, such as to contract, such as to marry, such as to manage their financial affairs.
To comply with court orders with regard to services.
Correct.
Is it your point that if there had been a guardianship,
the probate
court had appointed a guardian, that the court couldn't have proceeded under 161.003?
I think the court could have, but then the proper party would have been the guardian to have been served. See, my time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. It's been helpful. The case has been submitted, and you're free now to go about your business, or you may stay and listen if you want to the other arguments that we'll hear later this morning. Thank you.